then disappeared in a pool of blood. Mac lunged over the side, grabbing Jonas by the hair. He pulled, then grasped Jonas beneath his arms, hauling him into the boat.
"Oh, God!" cried Mac, gagging as blood gushed from a mangled appendage he could no longer identify.
Mac stole a quick glance over his shoulder to verify that the megalodon was moving out of the canal. Then, with a trembling hand, he reached his thumb and index finger into one of the gaping holes in his friend's leg. Feeling the noodle-like vessel bleeding out along his fingertips, he pinched, holding on desperately as he started the engine with his free hand and raced the pontoon boat into the lagoon. A magnificent hell. Western Pacific. Terry leaned back against the rail, allowing the morning sun to warm her face. Having barely slept, she would have preferred to spend the rest of the day in bed, but that would have aroused suspicion. Tokamak? What was Benedict working on in his lab? Could it have something to do with the benthos? She opened her eyes as the Epimetheus broke the surface 50 yards off the Goliath's stern. A diver rowed the winch's cable down to the sea, attaching several clips along the submersible's hull. Minutes later, the 68-foot cigar-shaped vessel swung into place and was lowered onto its docking platform. Benedict gave her a wave as he crossed the aft deck to greet the members of his A-team. Half of the B-team were already on board the Benthos, having made the journey to relieve their companions 2 days early. In less than 3 hours, Benedict and the remaining members of the crew would board the Prometheus for a week's mission in the trench. Terry watched Benedict through heavy eyes, wondering if he knew it was she who had broken into his lab. Just get the sonar records and get off this ship. Something was going on. Terry stood away from the rail, the surge of adrenaline snapping her awake. Across the deck, Benedict was engaged in a heated discussion with the A-team's captain. The two men looked over in her direction. Terry met Benedict halfway across the deck. Is there a problem?
It's my own fault, forgive me, Benedict said. The captain has correctly pointed out that the Benthos computers were specially designed and are not compatible with the Goliath or anything Jamstek would possess.
What does that mean?
It means that before the sonar records Jamstek requires can be brought topside, they must be converted to an acceptable format on board the Benthos.
Terry felt herself getting angry.
Fine, convert it, do whatever's necessary. Unfortunately, these things take time. The Benthos has been functioning with a skeleton crew. Converting the required information is not very difficult. In fact, you could do it yourself after 10 minutes of instruction, but it means tying up one of our people for at least 2, perhaps 3 shifts. The good news is that I'll be aboard the Benthos over the next week. I give you my word that I will do my best to isolate and convert the necessary data, or at the very least, complete a significant percentage of it.
That means I'm stuck on board the Goliath for at least another week?
Perhaps 2 if I cannot finish the work. I'm sure Jamstek will understand the delay.
Terry shook her head in protest, feeling her fatigue getting the best of her.
No, Benedict, they won't understand. In fact, if I repeat what you just told me, they'll probably cancel our contract immediately.
Benedict looked surprised.
Why would they do such a thing? Do they not trust us?
No, nothing like that. I think the Japanese just tend to be suspicious.
Suspicious of what?
I don't know. It doesn't matter.
It matters to me. I conduct business in good faith all over the world. Wherever I travel, my word is my bond. How dare the Japanese question me?
Benedict's face turned beet red, the veins in his neck throbbing.
Nemo me impune lacessit. No one attacks me with impunity. I will not allow myself to be bullied in any way by any nation. I shall cancel our contract.
No, wait! Terry panicked, her mind racing. She couldn't allow the Jamstek contract to be canceled. She also wanted to learn more about Benedict's secret lab.
Benedict, what about me? What if you showed me how to convert the data?
You?
Benedict shook his head.
You would have to join us aboard the Benthos. After what happened to your brother, your father would have me shot if he knew I had taken you into the trench.
He doesn't have to know. Benedict, please, it's the only way. If Jamstek cancels, it would ruin my father. Please! Benedict stared out to sea, enjoying the mind game.
I don't see how... Benedict, look at how much time and money GTI has already invested in this project. It's too important to just walk away. Give me a chance to satisfy Jamstek. I'll collect the data and stay out of your way.
Very well, Benedict said, moving in for the kill. But so there is no bad blood between your father and myself, I want you to write a letter by your own hand explaining that this is your decision entirely, absolving me of all responsibility.
Thank you. I'll prepare the letter, then I'll pack. How soon do we leave?
2 hours. Pack light. There's not much room on board the Prometheus.
Terry trotted across the deck, heading back to her cabin. Terry descended carefully through the conning tower into the main cabin of the Prometheus. The sub's four-man crew was at their stations, the remainder of the Benthos's B-team lying about or playing cards in the tiny galley. Benedict looked up from his workstation.
"Ah, guest of honor. Welcome aboard. Are you nervous, my dear?"
"Excited, actually. It's been a dream of mine to dive into the trench."
"Then this is a fortunate day. Come with me. I've reserved the best seat in the house for your first descent."
Benedict led her through the tight cylinder, the walls lined from floor to ceiling with computer consoles and electronic gadgetry. A dozen steel pipes ran overhead. At the center of the vessel, the grated walkway widened. Terry could see light coming from below. Benedict bent down and removed a 2-foot square of grating from the floor, revealing the entrance into the spherical observation pod located beneath the main cabin.
"Go ahead. Climb down and make yourself comfortable. When you get bored with the view, activate the computer and type in guest. The program will take you on a guided tour of the Benthos. Touch nothing else. If you get cold, there's a blanket beneath the seat."
Terry climbed down a short ladder, stepping into the one-seat pod. The spherical structure hung suspended beneath the submersible's hull like a World War II fighter plane's gun turret. An 8-inch porthole set at a 45-degree angle lay directly in front of her. A rush of adrenaline coursed through her. This was going to be fun. A metallic double clang and the track began moving. Moments later, the winch attached to the enormous steel frame reeled the Prometheus above the deck. The entire mechanism pivoted backward, swinging the vessel up and over the Goliath in a long, graceful arc. Terry watched the sea rush up at her as the submersible was released into the water. Swells tossed the vessel to and fro. Divers disconnected lines and inspected the array of gadgetry and rows of weight plates secured under the hull. One frogman gave Terry a wave before disappearing in an effervescence of bubbles. The Prometheus began sinking, descending slowly on its 6-hour journey into the unknown. Terry stared out at a blue world illuminated by the beams from a half-dozen underwater lights. She could see the tips of the robotic arms' mechanical fingers folded beneath the hull, as well as a series of cameras clustered below the bow. As they descended farther, the sea darkened from a deep shade of blue to a purple hue, before going utterly dark. Cold began to press in on her. She pulled out the blanket and wrapped it around her shoulders. Like its sister ship, the Epimetheus, the Prometheus was designed with a double hull of 6-inch thick titanium. In order to descend, the sub's main ballast tanks were flooded with seawater, making the vessel negatively buoyant. Upon reaching the trench, several steel plates secured along the underside of the hull would be jettisoned until the sub achieved neutral buoyancy. To surface, the remaining weights would be released. As they passed the 2-mile mark, Terry saw a twinkling of tiny lights beneath her window. 2 brown anglerfish appeared, each possessing enormous heads and frightful-looking jaws of needle-like teeth. From the top of their skulls, a fleshy projection dangled out and over their mouths, at the tip of which was a glowing light used to attract prey. The anglers darted back and forth in the sub's lights, eventually losing interest. Making herself comfortable, Terry pulled the computer's keypad onto her lap and typed in the word guest. The program booted. A Geotech industry emblem appeared, offering the user a choice of user languages. Terry manipulated the arrow to English, pressed enter, then waited for the program to begin.
"Welcome aboard the Benthos," crackled a feminine dubbed-in voice. "Geotech Industries' crowning achievement for deep-sea exploration."
The computer-animated image of the Benthos appeared, the vessel resembling the northern hemisphere of an enormous globe, cut in half along its equator. 3 claw-like legs dangled from beneath the ship's false flattened undercarriage. A scale replica of a 6-story building materialized next to the Benthos, only to be dwarfed by the dome-shaped object.
"The Benthos is a marvel of engineering and technology. The largest submersible ever built, it measures 230 feet from the peak of its dome to the bottom of its 3 retractable shock absorber legs. The diameter of its circular undercarriage extends a full 300 feet across. Submerged, the entire ship displaces 64,650 tons. The Benthos hull is composed of 18 layers of 6-inch titanium, 108 inches thick, capable of withstanding compressive forces in excess of 96 billion pounds. The hull of the vessel is actually a perfect sphere, its flattened underside a non-pressure cowling designed to support its ballast tanks. The interior of the Benthos is divided into 7 decks, each self-contained.
In the unlikely event of a hull breach on one deck, the remaining decks would maintain integrity. The computer image of the Benthos changed, its outer casing dissolving to reveal its internal compartments. As we can see, each deck is linked by a sealed stairway, or companionway, as well as an access tube that runs as a vertical connecting shaft down the very center of the vessel. Watertight hatches capable of withstanding pressures in excess of 16,000 pounds per square inch separate each adjoining level. Our tour begins at the top, or A deck. This domed section, which we call our observation deck, contains an additional interior shell composed entirely of 10-inch thick Lexan, a clear, impenetrable plastic. 30% of the outer titanium hull along A deck can be retracted like the dome of a telescope, revealing the unexplored beauty of the deep universe. B deck contains the bridge, or command center of the Benthos. Our computer and engine room is located directly below the bridge on C deck. D deck, the central and largest deck in our spherical sub, contains our galley, dining area, and recreation lounge. Crew's quarters are located on E deck, along with the ship's stores. Deck F is where the Benthos's nuclear reactor is housed, as well as a variety of equipment and mechanical rooms. The sub-single screw can also be accessed from here. The lowest level, its dimensions identical to the observation area, is G deck. It is here, at the bottom of the sub, where all entry into the Benthos takes place. Situated beneath the Benthos's hull is an abyssal docking station designed for the vessel's submersible transport ships, the Proteus, the Prometheus, and the Epimetheus. A pressurized vault originates just below G-deck. Mechanical docking arms located in the undercarriage position the submersible, lifting its conning tower up and into the flooded docking bay. Once the sub is sealed in place, this compartment drains and repressurizes, a feat made possible with using the combined efforts of 10 500-horsepower pumps, creating over 2,240,000 foot-pounds of force per cubic foot. G-deck also houses a 1,800-square-foot underwater hangar, which can be pressurized or vented using massive hydraulic ram pumps located on level F, allowing for deployment of heavy equipment or robotic operational vehicles into the abyss. Designed as both an exploratory vessel and deep-sea submarine docking center, the Benthos can remain within the deep at neutral buoyancy for months at a time. The ship's flat undercarriage is composed of two different types of pressurized ballast tanks. Gasoline-filled pontoon-like tanks provide positive buoyancy, while pressurized tanks filled with seawater can be adjusted to achieve both negative and neutral buoyancy. Forward maneuverability is made possible by our nuclear-powered SHG reactor, which provides steam to drive the electrical turbo generators and motor that turn the Benthos's single propeller shaft. Terry turned the computer off, wrapping herself tighter within the blanket. They had been descending for more than 3 hours now, more than 4 miles of ice-cold ocean above their heads. She closed her eyes. Terry woke with a start, feeling as if she were falling. Flailing her arms out to her sides, she grabbed hold of a console until she regained her equilibrium. 2 more hours had passed. She glanced at the depth gauge above her head. 34,487 feet. The view from her porthole had turned murky. She realized the temperature within the pod was rising. The Prometheus descended through a layer of dense sediment-like clouds, an abyssal ceiling of superheated water and minerals originating from beneath the seafloor. Spewed forth from towering hydrothermal sulfide chimneys, the suspended minerals helped maintain an insulated layer of warmth over many areas of the Mariana Trench. Minutes passed, the water gradually clearing. Another 50 feet and they descended into a canyon of shimmering black water whose temperatures varied from 50 degrees along its abyssal plains to upwards of 700 degrees directly above the mouths of its hydrothermal vents. They had reached bottom. An unfathomably large shadow loomed ahead. Terry could make out docking lights flickering on and off. The Benthos. Staring wide-eyed out the porthole, she watched in fascination as the long bow of the Prometheus slid within the docking assembly mounted along the undercarriage of the Benthos. With a groaning of rubber against metal, the sub stopped. Hydraulic sounds reverberated all around her as the docking assembly's arms raised the submersible into position. Terry could hear a pressurized sleeve being fitted over the sub's conning tower, and then a great whoosh of air as the compartment was sealed and repressurized. Benedict ducked his head into the pod. "To the extreme, at last." Terry climbed out of the spherical compartment, then followed Benedict up the conning tower ladder into a small chamber, its circular walls still moist with seawater. They exited out a pressurized vault door, entering Deck G of the Benthos. A barrel-chested man in his 40s greeted them. Benedict shook his hand, turning to Terry.
"Terry Taylor, this is Captain Breston Hopp. Welcome aboard the Benthos, Mrs. Taylor. We'll store your gear in Cabin 8, which is on E-Deck 2 levels up. We only have a few rules for our guests, but we ask you to follow them to the letter. There are only 2 passages leading to adjacent decks. When passing through, please be sure to secure all watertight doors behind you. In the unlikely event of a hull breach, titanium doors will automatically seal all hatches in the access tube, but the watertight doors must remain closed for the seals to lock into place. You may feel free to access any part of the vessel, with the exception of certain high-tech areas marked authorized personnel only. We also don't allow smoking on board."
"Not a problem."
"Captain, I'll join you in a few moments in the bridge," Benedict said. "First, I want to show our guest the observation room."
Benedict bypassed the companionway stairs, choosing to ascend directly through the core of the vessel by way of the vertical access tube. Terry followed him into the 10-foot diameter chute, then up the steel ladder, her arms aching by the time they reached A-deck. The circular room was just over 100 feet wide, its dome-shaped, cathedral-like ceiling rising 30 feet above their heads. Plush violet carpeting lined the expanse of floor. Suede chairs and luxurious down sofas ringed one half of the room, with a large oak conference table, chairs, and bar along the opposite side. Benedict moved to the wall behind the bar and reached for a series of switches mounted on a sophisticated control panel. The lights dimmed.
"From the moment we first descended from the trees, man has been an explorer," Benedict said, his voice echoing throughout the room. "We have conquered every corner of the world, and have circumnavigated the globe. We have probed the distant reaches of the galaxy and explored the nucleus of the atom. We've set foot on the face of the moon, landed on Mars, and have dispersed spacecraft to all the planets within our solar system. And yet, for all our accomplishments, we have barely penetrated the void that covers 65% of our own world's surface. Since the days of Galileo, millions have glimpsed the heavens, yet only a handful have gazed into the abyss. But it is here," he raised his voice, "here, within the deepest recesses of the ocean, that life truly originated. Since time began, an elixir of chemicals, the components of life itself, has been spewing forth from these unexplored depths. The answer to life's riddle is here, Terry. Yet man, for all his bravado, continues to fear the deep, terrified by its dark secrets and primal chaos."
Terry sensed a controlled madness in his voice.
"Audentes fortuna juvat. Fortune favors the bold. Like the great explorers before me, Marco Polo, Columbus, Magellan, Galileo, Hubble, Armstrong, Beebe, I dare to fail greatly so that I may achieve greatness."
Benedict hit a switch, extinguishing the interior lights. A deep rumbling reverberated overhead, and then a section of the domed wall began retracting.
"Behold, man's last, greatest, unexplored world!"
Terry stifled a scream, her heart racing in flurries as the titanium hull parted. She stared into the black heart of the abyss and thought of oblivion. Benedict's soothing voice came out of the pitch.
"Let there be light."
An eerie, incandescent red glow ignited from the benthos, the powerful lights revealing a vast alien world like nothing Terry could have ever imagined. The view overlooked a petrified forest of countless black smokers, whose chimney-like formations silently bellowed superheated water and smoke from its primordial stacks. At the base of the structures, some of which towered more than 6 stories, were clusters of albino clams and mussels and crustaceans, sprawling in worship around their source of nourishment. Freakish specimens of glowing fish wove in and out of the hydrothermal vents, swirling like pixie dust within the trench. It was a magnificent hell. Benedict stood before the window, his arms outspread, emerald eyes blazing as he reveled in his glory.
"I am the master of my fate, the captain of my soul. Winnie, Weedy, Weeky, I came, I saw, I conquered."
Propositions.
"Doctor, quick, he's awake!"
Still in the throes of his nightmare, Jonas sat up, thrashing, tearing the tubes from his arms. He tried to scream, gagging in the effort.
"We need some help here," called the nurse.
An orderly joined her. Together, they managed to strap Jonas's wrists to the guardrails. The doctor steadied the IV, injecting the hypodermic needle serum straight into the tube. Jonas felt lead seeping into his body. He floated backward, eyes half closed, staring up at the nurse. A man's face appeared. A dull light shone in one of his eyes, then the other. Jonas tried to protest, but his mind fell back into the abyss. Jonas opened his eyes. Sunshine. An enormous weight was lying on top of his left leg. He tried to kick it off. The sensation of 1,000 daggers stabbing his leg sent a jolt of pain coursing through every nerve of his body. In agony, he thrashed back and forth in bed, gagging on the object lodged in his throat. The doctor appeared overhead.
"Hang on, let's get that tube out of you. When I count to three, blow out hard. 1, 2, 3.
An object slid out of Jonas's throat. He gagged, then gasped a huge breath.
What?
Jonas rasped, his raw throat unable to voice the words.
"Try not to talk right away. You're in a hospital. You were attacked by a shark. We were able to save your leg, but you lost a lot of blood."
A wave of nausea washed over him. He closed his eyes and took several breaths, then tried to sit up.
"Wait, let me get those straps."
The physician unbuckled the leather bands from around his wrists. Jonas sat up. He stared at his left leg, which was heavily bandaged. The physician pointed to a series of moist orange-red dots where blood had oozed through the thick gauze padding.
"When they brought you in, you had 2 to 3 inch holes running from your mid-quad to just below the calf," the physician said. "I believe we counted 21 tooth marks, requiring 183 stitches, including a dozen just to close the femoral artery. By all rights, you should have bled to death."
Jonas whispered, "Mac."
"Your friend? Yeah, he saved your life. Actually reached into your leg and pinched off the artery with his fingers. We've had you on antibiotics over the last 3 days to prevent infection. Shark's teeth tend to be havens for germs."
3 days?
"Yeah, the worst is over. You'll be discharged tomorrow morning. The pain should begin letting up in about a week. Until then, it's painkillers and bed rest. Crutches if you need to move around. And I don't want you back in the water for at least another 2 months."
A nurse entered. She handed Jonas a cup of water.
"Your friend's outside, and there must be a dozen reporters downstairs waiting to speak with you.
You shouldn't be speaking to anyone right now. You need to rest." Jonas shook his head.
"Just Mac,"
he rasped. The doctor motioned his friend in, then followed the nurse out of the hospital room. Mac sat on the edge of the bed. He looked exhausted.
"Hey, shithead."
Jonas smiled.
"You sure look like shit. How do you feel?"
"Like Swiss cheese."
Jonas held out his hand weakly.
I really owe you this time."
Yeah, I'll put it on your tab."
"The Meg?"
"Gone."
Mac handed him a paper from earlier in the week. Jonas examined the front page. "Monster Shark Escapes" by Mike Clary, Los Angeles Times staff writer. Monterey. Carcharodon megalodon, the 72-foot, 62,000-pound prehistoric cousin to our modern-day great white, yesterday demolished the steel canal doors that had held it in captivity at the Tanaka Oceanographic Institute since its capture 4 years ago. A stunned capacity crowd of 10,000 could only watch as Angel fled her tank, escaping into the Pacific Ocean. Just as the creature freed itself, Jonas Taylor, the controversial paleobiologist who had only recently resigned from the Tanaka Institute, managed to tag the beast with a small transmitter. Authorities at the Institute are now tracking the megalodon, which appears to be heading north along the California coastline. In response to the creature's escape, authorities have ordered all Monterey beaches closed and have issued a small craft advisory, warning all boaters to stay clear of the area. See complete coverage on page 6A. Jonas put the paper down, staring at the ceiling. Mac smiled.
"Notice they give you all the credit for tagging the shark? Hey, Jonas."
Sorry, Mac. What did you say?"
"What the hell happened to you down there? All those great whites, what were they doing in the canal?"
Jonas closed his eyes.
"I know why the Meg's been agitated. I know why she escaped."
"So do I. She was hungry and she probably smelled all those delicious whales swimming by."
Jonas shook his head, looking at his friend.
"Angel's in estrus."
"Estrus? You mean she's in heat? How do you know that?"
"The great whites, they were all males. She must be giving off some kind of powerful scent. I guess I got caught in their mating ritual."
"Those puny 20-footers think they're going to impregnate that female?" Mac scoffed. "Shit, you'd stand a better chance of breeding a chihuahua with a Rottweiler."
"Those sharks don't want anything to do with the Meg. They were just lured into the area by their prehistoric cousin's scent.
So, what do we do now?
Jonas closed his eyes.
You're going to get us a weapon, something that can stop a tank. Once I heal up a bit, we're going to track our little angel down and kill her.
Ah, God damn it!
The stabbing pain snapped him out of his night terror. He lay back, catching his breath as he took in his new surroundings. He had absolutely no idea where he was. An adjoining door opened. He was shocked to see Celeste Singer emerge, wearing only a man's white dress shirt. Her long, silky legs moved toward him.
Доброе утро.
Is that good morning? My Russian's a bit rusty.
Да. Are you all right? You're screaming.
Yes. What are you doing here?
Christ, where the hell am I?
Just take it easy. I had you move to another room, one more private. The press can be difficult. I'm staying next to you in the adjoining room. Let me help you sit up.
I can manage. Celeste sat down on the edge of his bed. He caught a glimpse of beige silk underpants beneath the shirt. She squeezed his hand.
Jonas, darling, I really need your help.
Jonas felt himself becoming intoxicated by her scent. Her platinum blonde hair dangled over the nape of her neck, covering the swell of her breasts. He stared at the movement of pulse at the base of her throat. Looking at her mouth, her lips.
Stop it.
I need to use the bathroom. He swung his bandaged leg over the side of the bed, registering the painful throb from the rush of blood. Celeste grabbed his arm, helping him to his feet. Jonas stood, breathing heavily. He took a few painful steps to the bathroom.
Do you need any help in there?
Celeste asked playfully.
I can manage.
Jonas closed the door, locking it. He relieved himself, then stared at his reflection in the mirror. He looked pale, his face gaunt. The thick brown hair was graying quickly around the temples. He needed a haircut and a shave. The nightmare's real, Jonas. Find the creature and kill it, before it's too late. He emerged 15 minutes later, his breakfast laid out on a table before him.
Hope you're hungry, said Celeste. The nurse said the doctor will be stopping by in about an hour to check on you before you're released.
Why are you here, Celeste?
I need your help recapturing our fish.
Our fish? Sorry, I'm not interested.
I've arranged for a research vessel to meet us in Monterey. Everything we need will be on board and ready to go in 2 days.
Forget it.
I already ordered the contractors to begin repairs on the canal doors. They'll be working day and night while we track Angel down.
Celeste,
Jonas, you and Macready's tagged it. That's half the bottle right there. The shark's heading north. We have to recapture it, unless you'd prefer to stand by and watch it eat a few more people.
Jonas felt dizzy. He sat down on the edge of the bed and rubbed his forehead. Reality had suddenly become his worst nightmare. He felt as if destiny were dragging him down an inescapable vortex, which could only end in death. Celeste massaged his shoulders.
Don't. Relax, she cooed. I won't bite. Your shoulders are in knots.
Jonas winced as her fingers worked to loosen his muscles.
Thanks, that's fine. I need to get dressed.
Me too.
She stood and walked toward the adjoining room.
I brought you a change of clothing, just things you had left in your office. Everything's in the bathroom. Oh, here's your shirt.
She unbuttoned the shirt and slipped it off her naked shoulders, then tossed it to him with a smile. The late morning air was damp and cold, the heavy spring clouds threatening rain. The orderly wheeled Jonas out the front door to where a limo and a throng of reporters were waiting. Placing his foot gingerly on the gravel, he balanced himself on his crutches and stood before the open car door, turning to face the press. Celeste moved beside him.
Professor Taylor, how's the leg?
It hurts like hell.
Can you confirm that it was a great white shark that attacked you?
Yes, a 20-foot male. There's a rumor going around that the attack occurred within the Megalodon's canal as the creature broke free. Is that true, Professor? Yes.
A female reporter from Channel 5 pushed through the throng.
Professor Gail Simon, Channel 5 Live. In recent weeks, several marine biologists have publicly stated that the Megalodon's presence in the lagoon posed a clear and present danger to coastal populations. Now that the creature has escaped, would you feel responsible if others died?
The Tanaka Institute is tracking Angel as we speak, interrupted Celeste. Professor Taylor will be assisting us in recapturing her and permanently sealing her within the lagoon.
She pushed him inside the limo, climbed in next to him,
and slammed the door shut. Get us out of here.
Are you okay, Jonas?
The reporter's words continued to echo in his ears.
So, Professor, what's it going to take to convince you to help us track down and recapture your fish?
Funny, I thought it was our fish. I'm not the one haunted by a guilty conscience.
Jonas stared at her. What's that supposed to mean?
These night terrors of yours.
Who told you about that?
I read your medical reports. I heard you screaming this morning.
It's none of your business.
Jonas, darling, face it. Something's terrifying the hell out of you at the subconscious level. You know what I think? I think you still blame yourself for what happened in the trench 11 years ago.
Don't play amateur psychiatrist, Celeste. It's not your calling.
Life is not so complicated, Jonas. Your feelings of guilt over the deaths of the two scientists aboard the Navy submersible still haunt you. You think it's normal to wake up screaming every night?
You're way off base. Jonas stared at his bandaged leg. Besides, I'm dealing with it.
Really? Look at you. You're exhausted. Your second marriage is ending in divorce.
What did you say? Jonas grabbed her by the wrist.
Oh, I love it when you get rough.
She leaned her face close to his, taunting him. Jonas pushed her away. Don't play games. Who said I was getting divorced?
Your wife. Terry happened to mention that the two of you are having marital difficulties. The way she talked, it's all over.
You're lying. Since when does Terry talk to you anyway? She can't stand you.
We were the only two women aboard the Goliath. Who else was she going to talk to?
Jonas felt confused, unable to focus. He adjusted his leg, which continued to throb painfully.
Celeste, don't fuck with me, okay? I'm not in the mood.
Sorry, darling. I know it's none of my business, but I happen to care about you. Not that it matters, but she also mentioned the two of you had recently lost a child.
Jonas stared at her.
It's true?
There were some complications with the pregnancy. The baby died in the womb during the 8th month.
And this all happened during the trial?
Yes.
It's unfair, but it's my guess that Terry blames this on you.
She shook her head.
Benedict says American women don't handle stress very well. Your wife has convinced herself that her marriage to you is over, that the love is gone.
Shut up, Celeste. You know what? You're about the last person on earth I'd accept marital advice from.
Shoot the messenger if you wish, but
enough. They rode in silence for several minutes.
Jonas, forget Terry for a moment and think about the megalodon. I'm offering you the chance to finally put this shark business behind you. Help me recapture the female, and I promise you, I'll seal her up in the lagoon forever.
Forget it.
I'll pay you enough to retire, and you can finally get on with your life, with or without Terry.
Mac?
Jonas, where the hell are you?
I'm home. Listen, forget about hiring a vessel. We're going with Celeste.
Celeste? You're shitting me. Who's this on the phone? What happened to Jonas?
Just hear me out. Celeste wants my help recapturing the Meg. I negotiated a deal for both of us.
Listen, Jonas, all kidding aside, you tell that bitch to go screw herself and the horse she rode in on. I don't trust her as far as I can throw her.
Mac, Angel's tasted human blood and she's moving into populated coastal areas. Celeste's vessel is ready to go. We can't wait any longer. We need to move quickly.
Wake up, pal. She's using you.
No, Mac. This time I'm using her. Just get a hold of that weapon of yours. We leave port in 2 days. Feeding time. California coast. Propelled by the supple movement of its great tail, the female glided in silence through the depths. Despite its prodigious size, nature had endowed the megalodon, its most supreme hunter, for speed. From the tip of its blunt triangular snout, the muscular body tapered back, allowing it to soar through the water with minimal resistance. Beyond the vertical gill slits were the creature's massive horizontal pectoral fins, which worked like the ailerons of a jet fighter, controlling the creature's roll, yaw, and pitch. Pelvic fins maintained the shark's elevation, while the ominous 7-foot dorsal fin, a gracefully curving sail, held the creature steady as it moved through the sea. Propelling the megalodon through its environment was its powerful caudal or tail fin, at the base of which was the muscular peduncle, twice as wide as it was deep, which served as a keel, adding stability and strength to the tail. Just ahead of the caudal fin were two smaller fins, a secondary dorsal fin and an anal fin. These slight protrusions increased laminar flow across the predator's tail, helping to diminish drag further. Even the megalodon's skin contributed to its hydrodynamics. Made up of sharp scales or denticles,
The skin channeled the flow of water, decreasing drag while allowing the fish to move silently through its environment. Cruising just above stall speed, the female continued its journey north along the California coastline. Snake-like movements of its head allowed water to flow through grapefruit-sized troughs along the underside of its conical snout. Entering the nostrils, the seawater passed into the nasal cavity, coming in contact with a series of lamellae that allowed it to detect even the smallest traces of chemical odor in the water. The predator rose through the thermocline, picking up the scent of its prey. The humpback pod remained close to the surface, swimming in majestic up-and-down movements created by their colossal horizontal flukes. Every so often, a 40-ton cow would breach, exhaling a towering spout of moist air before sucking in a breath through twin nasal blowholes. Haunting groans and squeals echoed beneath the waves as the pod communicated with its own. Having detected the powerful scent of the advancing hunter, the whales closed ranks, mothers nudging their young closer to the surface. It was not long before the wolf entered the arena to circle the flock. Sensory cells peppered beneath the shark's snout detected the faint electrical fields generated by the whale's beating hearts and swimming muscles. The hunter quickly targeted the young, moving in for the kill. Walls of heaving blubber crashed down upon the charging female snout. The inexperienced hunter veered away, then darted back into the fray. Pushing its nose through the surging behemoths, the shark attempted to latch its teeth into the nearest calf. The cows turned upon the intruder, attempting to ward off the shark with headbutts and powerful slaps from their flukes. The megalodon retreated, then circled again. Half Moon Bay Beach, 18 miles south of San Francisco. Ken Burke finished setting up the lounge chair for his wife, Emily, who was busy applying sunblock to the faces and shoulders of their three young children.
"You can play by the water, but don't go in," she warned.
"But it's hot, Mommy," the youngest complained.
"Daddy will take you in later."
"Daddy's reading his newspaper," Ken said, lying back on his lounge chair.
"Hey, guys, look at all the whales in the water."
Broad lead-gray backs rolled across the churning surface 80 yards offshore. The megalodon closed again, this time approaching from beneath the fleeing pod. The hunter targeted one of the calves and accelerated, barreling its way through a sea of foam and slapping flukes. Unable to reach the calf, the frustrated predator snapped its jaws upon the enormous tail of a 68,000-pound cow. Dragged back from the surging pod, the humpback cow groaned, twisting in ponderous contortions to reach its calf, which was floundering alone along the surface. The megalodon shook its head like a dog engaged in a tug of war, grinding its serrated teeth through the whale's muscular tail in seconds. Blood gushed from the mutilated appendage. The distressed whale moaned in agony. Propelling itself with canoe-sized flippers, the adult struggled to the surface, attempting to nudge her calf into shallower waters, even as it bled to death. The megalodon followed the blood trail. The hunter rolled sideways, propelling itself along the surface, then opened its mouth and inhaled the trail of blood into its gullet until its jaws clamped down on the remains of the fluke. Writhing in its death throes, the dying mammal lurched forward, repeatedly pushing its offspring to shore.
"Daddy, can you carry me out to pet the whales, too?"
The child's voice startled Ken from his catnap.
"What? Honey, what did you say?" "It's not fair. Michael's petting them."
Ken sat up to see his 12-year-old wading out into chest-deep water.
"Oh, shit. Michael, get back here!"
Ken ran into the ocean and grabbed the boy around the waist.
"Dad, wait, the baby's stuck!"
Ken watched the stranded 14-foot creature struggle to free itself. The enormous head of its mother bobbed up and down from behind, as if trying to reach its young. Ken felt a surge of undertow pull on his legs.
"Okay, Mike, here's the deal. I'll try to help her, but I want you to stay on shore with your mother."
Ken carried his son into shallower waters, then waded back out in water up to his chest. Hesitantly, he reached out and touched the calf along its pectoral fin as he eyed the larger cow, straining to reach its offspring 30 feet back. Ken pulled on the fin, quickly losing his balance.
"What the hell am I doing? I can't do this myself."
The mother raised her head, contorting her upper torso.
"Okay, I'm trying."
Ken looked into the calf's huge, brownish-red eye. He placed both hands against the side of the animal's head and pushed, slipping as the undertow gripped him again. A woman in her early 20s and her two male companions joined him.
"Hold on, man, we'll give you a hand."
Together, they began pushing the struggling calf away from the sandy bottom.
"Hey, buddy, are you bleeding?"
"Huh?" Ken looked at his chest, which was covered in blood.
Oh, shit. No, it's coming from the mother,
the woman pointed out. The cow's mammoth head rose out of the water and let out a deep moan. Behind the beast, something was battering the surface waters, spraying great froths of lather in all directions. The megalodon snaked its way along the sloping sandy bottom, straining to reach its prey. Twisting sideways, a pectoral fin slapping above the waves, the hunter bit down on the whale's bleeding muscular peduncle and attempted to drag the beached behemoth, tail first, back out to sea. Ken's feet slipped away from the bottom as the powerful undertow dragged him into deeper water.
Hey, man, can you tell if the calf's fluke is free?
Her fluke? You mean her tail?
Ken asked. Cautiously, he moved behind the calf.
I can't see a damn thing. The tail's submerged.
Feeling the undertow pulling him into deeper water, he dove forward, swimming hard against the current while trying to stay clear of the adult humpback thrashing 10 feet behind him. The megalodon registered the vibrations of the new life form. Releasing the cow, it flailed along the surface in 20 feet of water, its nostrils snorting the surface like a mad bull. Ken looked up to see the two men abandon the calf, pulling their female companion into shallow water. Back on the beach, 2 dozen onlookers were waving frantically. He saw his wife, heard her scream. A wave of fear tingled through his stomach. He turned to look over his shoulder, allowing the current to drag him backward another 5 feet.
Oh, my fucking God!
The freakish great white thrust its head forward, snapping its jaws 10 feet behind him. Ken lunged forward and swam against the powerful undertow. The megalodon's sickle-shaped tail slapped the surface, its garage-sized head twisting to and fro. Exhausted, the out-of-shape 40-year-old was forced to rest, barely able to raise his arms. As he drifted backward, his left foot made contact with something that felt like sandpaper.
Oh, shit!
Adrenaline surging through his body, Ken dove forward and swam with all his strength, keeping his head underwater to streamline his upper torso as he distanced himself from the creature's snout. Swimming blindly, he rammed his head against the side of the calf, gasping as he came up for air. Pushing off the stranded whale with 2 feet, he dove forward, managing to catch an incoming swell. A pair of arms reached out for him. He swam through them, continuing until his chest literally scraped along the bottom. Then he stood, the world spinning, as he staggered onto the beach and collapsed next to his sobbing wife and children. The adult humpback reared up onto its flippers, lifting its head above the waves. In its final moment of life, the beast managed to trumpet its death call, an agonizing exhalation of pink spray. A hushed crowd of onlookers watched in awe as an imposing pale white dorsal fin, streaked with smears of scarlet foam, zigzagged across the surface. The monstrous shark slammed into the submerged carcass of its dying prey, the exposed upper lobe of its crescent moon-shaped tail thrashing wildly about, dousing the mutilated whale with its own innards. Ken shivered, his heart beating rapidly, as he watched the tortured mammal being towed backward into the sea, its head disappearing beneath a pool of blood. Bad Karma. Monterey, California. Docked along a stretch of pier, the 163-foot research vessel William Beebe glistened beneath the cloudless morning sky, its 3 upper decks buzzing with activity. Technicians in the bow were busy mounting a towering 25-foot satellite communications antenna designed to link the ship to SOSUS, the Navy's network of undersea microphones. Low-frequency signals emitted by the transmitter attached to the megalodon's hide were already being detected by the underwater sound surveillance system. Traveling by way of fiber-optic cable, the sounds fed into a global arrangement of processing stations situated along the Pacific coast. With the antenna in place, the working stations could uplink the acoustical information via satellite to computers on board the William Beebe, allowing the crew to track the animal nearly anywhere in the world. Jonas made his way slowly along the wooden pier, limping heavily, a duffel bag slung over his right shoulder. The morning sun felt good on his face. He found the cawing of gulls and the creak of boards beneath his feet somehow comforting. As he approached the vessel, he noticed a familiar figure seated alone on one of the benches facing out to sea.
Maseo?
Without looking up, the elder Japanese patted the bench, signaling his son-in-law to take a seat. Maseo stared at the bandaged leg.
Why are you doing this, Jonas?
He asked, his voice raspy and weak. Jonas noticed Maseo's hands were shaking. I think we both know the answer to that. Maseo continued staring at the Pacific.
There is much bad karma surrounding this voyage. You have looked death in the face twice now. I've already lost one son because of this monster. I do not wish to lose another.
Jonas looked into the old man's almond eyes. I began this. Only I can end it.
In your mind, I know you believe that to be true. There's too much hate in your heart to see clearly. There's no reason to jeopardize your life again. If you can't think of yourself, then think of my daughter.
I am. They watched the one-man submersible, Abyss Glider 1, as it was lowered onto the aft deck of the ship. The sight caused Jonas's heart to race. Why is that being loaded on board?
Celeste says the sub is needed to secure the creature in its harness once it has been harpooned and drugged.
Maceo saw fear wash over his son-in-law's face.
What is it?
Never mind. It's nothing.
Tell me.
Jonas rubbed his bloodshot eyes. The night terrors I've been experiencing, in a lot of them I'm piloting the Abyss Glider into the trench. Maceo squeezed Jonas's hand.
Terry told me about your dreams. That is why I would only permit the AG-1 to be loaded on board, not its deep water version.
Thank you.
Still, I don't want you to pilot that sub.
He doesn't have to. Celeste came strolling down the pier, accompanied by a man in his late 40s. Meet Richard Diefendorf, our new submersible pilot. Dief, this is Maceo Tanaka and Dr. Jonas Taylor.
Hey, Doc, a real pleasure to meet you.
Diefendorf placed his cigarette into his mouth so he could shake Jonas's hand. Jonas couldn't help but stare at the man's partially bald scalp that brandished a fresh sunburn and not like welt.
Richard, have you ever piloted one of these one-man subs?
Hey, call me Dief. All my friends do. Yeah, I've piloted the Abyss Glider a few times, but never in water as deep as you have. Celeste tells me this job is fairly routine. I'm curious why you guys even need me along.
Jonas looked up at Celeste. There's nothing routine about capturing a 72-foot shark.
Don't let him worry you, Dief, she said. The creature will be drugged long before we lower you into the water.
Well, if it's so easy, why not have Dr. Taylor?
We need Dr. Taylor on board to coordinate the shark's capture,
Celeste said, flattening the short gray hair sticking out along the side of Dief's balding head.
Besides, Jonas is wounded.
A deep thrumming echoed off the water. They looked up to see a small white helicopter with green trim circling down to the forward deck of the William Beebe.
Is it really necessary to bring Macready's along? Celeste asked.
We need Mac to help us pinpoint the Meg's location.
No offense, Jonas, but I don't trust the man. I'd prefer my own helicopter and pilot.
Mac and I are a team. If he doesn't go, neither do I.
Fine, fine, just get on board already.
Celeste marched off toward the ship, Dief in tow. Maceo stood.
I wish you'd reconsider.
I'm sorry, Mass. I'm sorry about a lot of things. It was my fault you had to sell the Institute to Singer.
Stop. No one is to blame. Since you won't listen to reason, go and do what you must. Just come home in one piece. Terry and I will be waiting.
Jonas started to say something, then thought better of it. He squeezed the old man's shoulder and headed for the end of the dock. As the newest addition to the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute's shipboard science fleet, the William Beebe was a floating laboratory designed for a wide range of ocean research missions. The vessel was divided into three upper and three lower decks. An enormous mast rose high at its center, holding lights, navigation antennas, a crow's nest, and the ship's radar. Below the mast, occupying the smallest of the upper decks, was the control room and pilot house. One deck below was the officers' quarters, followed by the third or main deck, which housed the staterooms and ship's labs. At the stern of the main deck stood an enormous A-frame and winch designed to raise and lower heavy equipment overboard. Two motorized rubber rafts hung suspended on either side of the ship, along with a heavy cargo net. The net would be used to tow the captured megalodon back to the lagoon. Scientific storerooms, the ship's galley, the sick bay, and an enormous engine room comprised most of the lower decks. Jonas boarded at the stern, pausing to watch a high-tech harpoon gun being mounted into the deck. When readied, the barbed head of the harpoon would be filled with a massive dose of tranquilizers. Two of the ship's officers approached.
Professor Taylor, I'm George Morgan, captain of the William Beebe. This is my first officer, Harry Moon. Harry's had quite a bit of experience with SOSUS back at Woods Hole.
Harry extended his hand.
I know you've been through this before. Any advice you care to share with us?
Yes, after you harpoon the beast, move your vessel away as fast as you can.
Why?
Harry asked, tugging at a gray hair in his bushy eyebrow. The drugs caused the first creature to react violently. It attacked and crippled the Kiku, which was a lot larger than this vessel.
That's because you had no idea what you were doing.
A man in his late 20s joined them. He was wearing a tie-dyed shirt, his shoulder-length brown hair pulled back into a tight ponytail.
Professor Taylor, this is Mike Marin.
Dr. Marin, if you don't mind. I'm an ichthyologist. You amaze me, Taylor, you really do. 4 years ago, you shot up an adult Carcharodon megalodon with near-lethal dosages of ketamine and pentobarbital, and you wonder why the fish went ballistic on you. Unbelievable.
Jonas felt his temper flaring. At the time, no one could have predicted how the creature would react.
You should have tested your concoction on smaller sharks first, or at the very least contacted us at Woods Hole. If you had, we would have advised you against using the pentobarbital. It's amazing your little chemical cocktail didn't kill the animal. Instead, it wore off prematurely, allowing the fish to slaughter a few more innocent people.
Jonas stepped forward, pushing Marin backward with one hand. Do you have a problem?
Yeah, I have a problem with gutless stupidity.
Jonas grabbed Marin by the shirt collar with both hands and lifted him off his feet. It took the combined effort of Captain Morgan and Harry Moon to get Jonas to release his grip on the stunned scientist, whose tie-dyed T-shirt was torn apart in his assailant's hands.
You're nuts, Taylor, Marin yelled. And you're dangerous. It's your fault all those people died.
Marin, get out of here, the captain yelled.
Jonas pointed a finger menacingly at the younger scientist's face. Stay out of my way or I'll shove a hook up your ass and use you for bait. Mac joined the group as Marin skulked back to his lab.
Damn, looks like I missed all the fun.
I want to apologize for Marin's behavior, Captain Morgan said. You should know that he's as brilliant as he is obnoxious.
He's devised a method to feed medication continuously into the megalodon once we harpoon it, Harry added. It's like a giant IV tube. We won't have to worry about the creature waking, and the mixture of drugs should put it to sleep right away without the violent side effects you had to go through.
Oh, wonderful, Jonas said. When do we get underway? Captain Morgan checked his watch.
20 minutes. Harry, would you show these gentlemen to their quarters?
Jonas picked up his duffel and followed the first officer inside. Trapped. Mariana Trench. Terry felt the eyes of the Benthos crew upon her as she sat alone at the small table, picking at her powdered eggs. The excitement of being aboard had quickly turned to anxiety and a strange foreboding sense. The depths did not frighten her. It was Benedict. The man had changed, his entire persona undergoing a frightening metamorphosis since their arrival in the abyss. A dark monomania had emerged, a hidden malignity freed within the confines of the Benthos. Narcissistic rage was slowly being released in a fine madness, a madness she was certain was fueled by Benedict's true purpose for being in the trench. Terry knew she had stumbled upon something vastly more important to Benedict when she had invaded the Goliath's lab. Although she still had no idea as to its significance, she now realized that Benedict had lured her into the deep. He had baited the trap, and she had plunged in willingly, and now everything in her being told her that Benedict Singer was intent on keeping her captive. The Russian stood over her, a sheepish grin plastered on his sea-worn face.
Benedict wants you.
Terry recognized the scar slicing across the man's throat. The drunk Russian technician aboard the Goliath. She felt herself shudder. Where is he?
I take you.
Her heart pounded heavily in her chest. She stood, nodding to the Russian to lead the way. As he turned his back, she grabbed a steak knife from her plate, slipping it nonchalantly into the back pocket of her jeans. The Russian pulled open the watertight door of the companionway, beckoning her inside. He motioned down the steps. She began descending the narrow stairwell, pausing at E-deck. He pointed downward with his index finger, smiling as if toying with her. They exited on G-deck, the lowest level of the Benthos. The Russian led her through a brightly lit antiseptic corridor. Benedict was waiting for them at the end of the passage.
Ah, there she is, an angel in the depths of hell. Did you sleep well?
The emerald eyes glittered down at her. Yes, thank you. I'm actually anxious to get back to the sonar records. Everything looks to be in order, she lied. Just as you said.
Of course, my dear, but first a brief distraction before you continue your toil at the computer.
He pointed to the thick titanium door leading into the hangar. What's inside? She asked, unable to disguise her fears.
Are you nervous about something?
No, it's just, well, doesn't the hangar lead directly outside?
Benedict smiled at the Russian and translated. Both men laughed.
Come with me, he said, pushing open the door.
The hangar was a circular chamber, 60 feet long and 30 feet deep, its concave ceiling rising 20 feet above the bowl-shaped flooring. To their right was another door leading into a small control room sealed in 9 feet of titanium and portholes of Lexan glass. Moving beyond the control room, Terry located two massive inlets constructed beneath the hangar floor, each of the 5-foot openings covered by titanium grating. An array of powerful air ducts lined the ceiling. Benedict walked across the chamber to an immense titanium door.
Come here, Terry. I want to show you something.
She joined him, aware that the Russian had entered the small control booth.
Touch this door. It's 6 feet thick titanium, paper thin in these depths, and all that separates us from instantaneous death.
He pressed his face to the metal.
Can you feel the pressure behind it? It's searching, probing our technology for the tiniest flaw to exploit.
Benedict slapped his palm against the titanium. Terry jumped. He smiled, placing a heavy arm across her shoulder, pulling her ear close to his mouth.
Look here, he whispered, pointing to the grating on the floor. With a flick of the switch, Sergei can vent this chamber.
The Russian smiled back at her from behind the control room window.
To hold such power over life, even for a moment, is to play God, is it not?
Benedict could feel her shaking. He smiled, releasing his grip on her shoulder, walking away.
Quos Deus vult perdere prius dementat,
he mumbled to himself.
Those whom a god wishes to destroy, he first drives mad.
He strolled to the far end of the room, where 2 dozen Eunice robots were lined up in rows of 4.
Your father's inventions, standing in line like little children waiting to board a school bus. Give me a hand, he said, his demeanor changing.
Terry joined him. Using a specially designed forklift, they secured one of the 5-foot-high by 4-foot-wide titanium barrels and pulled it across the room, positioning it next to the hangar door. Attaching a custom-made fitting to the end of a drill, Benedict unbolted the robot's watertight, pressurized seal, as if removing lug nuts to change a tire. Having removed the bolts, he proceeded to unscrew the 2.5-foot titanium lid, pulling it aside to reveal the complex inner workings of the hollow Eunice device. Benedict motioned to the insides of the deepwater robot.
Would you do the honors?
Terry reached inside the shell, located the main control panel, and activated the sonar device. Once buried within the seafloor, the unmanned nautical information submersible would begin recording and tracking seismic disturbances in the Mariana Trench. By dispersing the 25 robots at selected intervals, the Japanese would have an array of seismic detectors providing them with an advanced warning system to predict and prepare for earthquakes along their island chain. Benedict resealed the top of the Eunice.
We'll leave the robot close to the hangar door. The Prometheus will extract it from the flooded chamber using its mechanical arms, then transport it to the designated coordinates. I'll be heading out this morning with the sub. I'd invite you to come along, but I know you're anxious to return to your work.
She followed Benedict toward the exit.
I have an idea, he said. Why don't you watch us extract the Eunice from inside the control room? It really is quite fascinating, and I'm sure Sergei would enjoy your company.
Terry's pulse raced. Perhaps another time. Jamstack really is waiting for...
Nonsense! Seize the day!
Benedict pulled open the control room's heavy titanium door, motioning her inside. Sergei grinned. Benedict closed the hydraulic door behind him, then exited the chamber. Terry watched the Russian unlock a large valve on the control console, turning it 6 times in a counterclockwise motion. On the other side of the Lexan window, thousands of gallons of seawater blasted upward from 1 of the 2 circular gratings on the floor of the hangar. Within minutes, the entire chamber filled with water. Sergei turned to her. With the hangar flooded, the 2 of them were trapped together in the control room.
"We must wait for the sub," he said, grinning.
Terry tried to make conversation.
How is the Benthus able to drain the chamber so quickly? It must take an ungodly amount of power to...
Water is not sent directly to sea. From chamber it is pumped into smaller catches, then pumped out over several hours using hydraulic rams on F-deck.
He unbuckled his pants.
Enough talk.
The pulse in her neck throbbed. She reached behind her back, grasping the handle of the steak knife.
"Sergei, don't!"
Sergei lunged forward, grabbing her by the hair, pulling her face to his, and buried his tongue in her mouth. Terry bit down hard, tasting his blood. She spit it out onto his chest, then